Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We do not have a quorum, and we may not get a quorum. The way it looks, it seems like the hallways are clogged today, so that's, at least I prefer to accept that excuse. But today's hearing is informational only. We will not be voting on any bills today, so that's not a big problem. In case you're wondering, I have my very own sugar beet with me today that I just received from the sugar beet growers. It's a very happy little beet, and I think he's happy because he got away, apparently. He's got feet and everything. Anyway, they're in town today talking about sugar beets. So today we are going to first hear from the department. They have a PowerPoint, and we'll do the PowerPoint first, and then we'll hear from the auditor, and then we'll go back and explore the questions. So as soon as whoever is going to do the PowerPoint is ready to dive into it, we'll move forward. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with the presentation.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Cassandra O'Hearn. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. We had some trouble with the PowerPoint, so I apologize for that. There are copies of it now in your packets. Excuse me while I just rearrange. There's cords. Okay. The Department of Public Safety is a statewide mission and impact to protect citizens and communities, prepare, prevent, respond, recover, educate, and engage in enforcement activities, focus on saving lives and providing efficient and effective public safety services while always maintaining public trust and developing strong partnerships. The department, we've done an overview in front of this committee previously, but as a reminder, are split between the Transportation Committee and Public Safety as well. So the divisions that are under this committee are the State Patrol, the Office of Traffic Safety, Driver and Vehicle Services, the Office of Pipeline Safety, and our Administrative and Related Services. Those include our Commissioner's Office, Human Resources, Fiscal and Administrative Services, and Affirmative Action as well. Under the Public Safety, just so there's a good understanding of the breadth of the work of the department, are also the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division, the State Fire Marshal Division, Office of Justice Programs, Emergency Communication Networks, Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. The total department base budget for this current biennium that we're in right now, and this includes both transportation and public safety divisions, can be broken out as representative on the slide. With trunk highway funds, general funds, special revenue accounts, and the highway user tax distribution account. Total, about $730 million. We have an equal number on expenses, a majority being our employee compensation costs and fringe benefits, and other operating costs. Those would include rent, our leases, supplies, IT costs, things along those lines. There are also required transfers and direct local assistance that is provided out of those services as well. Now what I'll do is briefly discuss each one of the divisions underneath the Transportation Committee here and talk a little bit about what programs are used under there, and then talk about the fiscal 17 budget and how that breaks down. Our administrative and related services, as I mentioned, human resources, our fiscal administrative services. It includes also our IT services, communications, the commissioner's office, affirmative action. In fiscal 17, the resources, now these are not by NEM resources, so it does include carryover from fiscal 16, but those resources are $23.56 million. And the breakdown, you can see on the slide, but it's $6.57 million out of the general fund, special revenue account, $7.08 million, trunk highway, $6.81 million, highway user tax distribution, the HUTD, $2.72 million, and federal funds, nominal amount at $379,000. The State Patrol services provide for the safe and efficient movement of traffic on Minnesota's roads and highways. They assist motorists and investigate crashes. They partner with other law enforcement agencies to respond to incidents. They inspect school buses and commercial vehicles. They provide security within the Capitol complex and in all state buildings within the Twin Cities. And they provide aviation services as well, which are not provided by any other entity in our state. Program activities to give you put into context in, these are 2016 numbers, so a complete year there, of 640,000 enforcement contacts. They investigated over 27,000 crashes, made 5,400 impaired driving arrests. Troopers traveled 18.2 million miles in their enforcement activities, providing 76,000 assists to the public, assisting local agencies 23,000 times, investigating and responding to over 60,000 driving complaints that were received from the public, engaged in 37,000 commercial vehicle driver safety inspections, and inspected over 21,000 school buses. These, of course, are rounded numbers, just for the ease of conversation. In fiscal year 17, their resources amount to $125.45 million, including a little over $9 million from the general fund, $11 million from the special revenue, over $100 million from the trunk highway, $891,000 from the HUTD, and $3.31 million of federal funds. The Office of Traffic Safety supports programs to reduce traffic fatalities and serious injuries through increasing seatbelt use, decreasing impaired driving, moderating speeds, and reducing distracted driving behavior. The Office of Traffic Safety provides leadership to the Towards Zero Deaths program, which is a partnership with MnDOT and the Department of Health. They provide funding and support for public education and outreach, traffic enforcement, policy development, and community traffic safety programs. Last year, they provided over 200 grants to local units of government and nonprofit agencies to improve motorists' behavior. They provide research analysis and program evaluation to determine the programs that they fund, whether they are effective, and how that influences traffic crash trends and emerging issues. They administer the motorcycle safety and child safety child seat for needy families programs, which are supported by state special revenue funds. And they administer approximately $16.5 million in grants from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, otherwise known as NHTSA. In fiscal year 17, their resources are $44.65 million. They receive none from the general fund. They do receive a little over $1 million from the special revenue account, $472,000 from Trunk Highway, nothing from the HUTD, and $43.1 million in federal funds. The special revenue account is derived, there's about $900,000 that come from motorcycle safety funds, and that comes from the motorcycle endorsement on driver's licenses. And then About $100,000 is comes from for the child seats for needy families, and that is derived from the fine for individuals that are fined for not using child seats appropriately. Driver and Vehicle Services maintains the integrity of our driver's licenses and identification cards, motor vehicle title issuance process, and vehicle registration to ensure the accuracy and security of these documents to prevent fraud and protect public safety. DVS collects revenue and performs audits to ensure that the correct payment of taxes and fees. And they also regulate over 3,000 auto dealerships in Minnesota, and 174 deputy registrars perform the work of those various services. They issue a lot of documents. We have over 1 million motor vehicle titles, over 4 million motor vehicle registrations, those are the tabs in your cars, provided 613, almost 614 driver's license knowledge and skills tests for new drivers, issued over 1 million driver's licenses and identification cards, issued over 25,000 enhanced driver's license, enrolled almost 10,000 citizens in the Ignition Interlock driving program. They collected $89.7 million in registration and fuel taxes from Minnesota trucking companies and collected over $645 million in motor vehicle registration taxes. In fiscal year 17, their financial resources are just over $131 million, which includes no funding from the general fund, $131 million in special revenue, nothing from the Trunk Highway, nothing from the HUTD, and $570,000 in federal funds. Driver and Vehicle Services is also responsible in working in partnership with Minute to create the new Minnesota Drivers or Licensing and Registration System, otherwise known as MNLARS. This is the new computer system that will replace the existing legacy system as the entire system for the issuing of driver's licenses, in, identification cards, and all things motor vehicle as well, titling and registration. Their mission is to build and deliver the best secure driver and vehicle information system that is within budget, easy to use and maintain, and allows for future enhancements. And that includes being able to be responsive to the legislature when you choose to change items, which in the past have been very difficult to do in the current system. The system will be much more flexible. The goals are to reduce transaction processing time. Driver Vehicle Services is very aware of the processing times, and some are within acceptable range and some have not been within acceptable range. But the goal is to reduce those transaction processing times, to improve data security, accuracy, consistency, and security. I said that, sorry. Improve customer assistance and communication. Standardize processes, so it's the same process no matter where somebody gets their credentials the services that they ask for. Reduce paperwork and paper flow, which makes the system more efficient, more timely, and increase customer convenience. I'm going to give a really brief history. In 2008, the department requested funding from the legislature in order to move forward with a new system. Okay. From 2009 to 2010, that was the process of identifying the requirements that were necessary and would be put in the request for proposals, the RFP process that was used to secure a vendor to create this system. In 2000, 2011 through 2012 was that request for proposal process, the RFP process. During that time, or in 2008, there was a projected cost. When the request for proposals were received, they exceeded the amount that was estimated that it was going to cost for the project. So it was at that time that there was a request for additional funds. It was in the 2011-2012 time period. HP was awarded the contract and began work, and worked on the project until 2014, when the state, working with Minute, Driver Vehicle Services, the Department of Administration, all worked together to determine that the product that was being provided by HP was not going to work. So at that time, made the very difficult decision to stop that project and take it on with Minute, in partnership with Minute, to develop it internally. The funding, however, during that period of time, what was determined for the budget that HP was going to need to develop the project, did not increase. So that same budget is what MNLARS is currently working on. There was not an increase in funding by that decision. There were some pieces that were developed by HP which are being integrated into the MNLARS system. So all was not lost. They picked up from that point and moved forward. Now, there have been other things, so that's as much as I'm going to add on the MNLARS. If there are questions, we can certainly get other individuals to speak to that. The Office of Pipeline Safety is another unit under, that's funded by transportation funding. There are over 65,000 miles of natural gas and hazardous liquid pipelines in Minnesota. The Office of Pipeline Safety ensures that these pipelines are safe and works statewide to prevent underground utility damage. They review pipeline operator procedures, training, and records to ensure, again, that these pipelines are safe. They conduct inspections to ensure that the pipeline systems are operating safely. And they also engage in the call before you dig education and enforcement. Last year, they inspected over 107 pipeline operators and more than 65,000 miles of pipeline. They provided over 5,800 utility operators and excavators and more than 800 emergency responders with education and training throughout Minnesota. And they conducted nearly 8,000 hours of inspection and operator training. For fiscal 17, their resources are $3.4 million. They received no money from the general fund, $1.45 million from special revenue, and $1.96 from federal funds. And that concludes the PowerPoint.
Thank you, Ms. O'Hearn. Representative Mason has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding the pipeline safety, does Minnesota have a policy for once pipelines are vacated, do you still inspect them? And do you know if they're made to, is there requisite that the pipes be removed after they're abandoned?
Ms. O'Hearn.
I do not know the specific answer, but I believe I have somebody who does know the answer.
That helps.
Like we have a pipeline safety expert coming forward. Please identify yourself for the record and answer the question.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Bruce West. I'm the Minnesota State Fire Marshal, and also the Director of the Minnesota Office of Pipeline Safety. The answer to your question is no and no. If a pipeline has been vacated, we do not inspect it, and it's not required that they remove it.
Thank you.
Follow-up, Representative Mason?
I'm sorry?
I was seeing if there was a follow-up question.
No, that'll do. Thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thank you. So could I use those pipes to drain my farm field or something, you know, since they're just laying around?
Mr. Chair, if you'd like to dig them up and use that, you sure could.
Thank you. All right. I'm sorry. Representative Hausman.
So how often, thank you, Mr. Chair, does it happen often, and what do we know about the, what are the implications of pipes left in the ground?
Mr. Chair.
That's fine.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it does not happen very often, and we're always communicating with the pipeline companies if they are vacating an area, so then we'll have it in our records. We have record system within the Office of Pipeline Safety, so if it's a two-mile vacation of a pipe, then we'll note that in our record system.
And that, Mr. Chair, that record stays there.
Absolutely.
Forever.
Stays within our office.
Well, thank you. Now, Ms. Representative Mason has a follow-up.
One other question. If the pipeline is on a private land, does the owner have any authority in asking that the pipeline be removed?
Mr. West.
Mr. Chair and committee members, that is a good question, because one of the issues we have is with farm taps. You know, if a gas line goes across the private property, the owner of that farm tap, let's say, which is the private landowner, should know where that farm tap goes, because that's not one that is within the jurisdiction for locating that by locating company or, you know, the transmission company, because that is a privately owned facility, let's call it, privately owned pipe that's going across a farmer's field or wherever it's going to hook up to his property.
Follow-up
person, Mason.
So the question is, if a pipe is vacated, there is, it sounds like the owner is bearing the responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So could they ask to have the pipe totally removed?
Mr. West.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the individual landowner could remove that pipe, and then they would let us know that, and then we would have that in our records.
Okay. But wouldn't it be the responsibility of the company that put the pipe in to take it out?
Mr. West.
Mr. Chair and committee members, that would be a question that I would ask one of our principal engineers who's here as far as the requirement on that. Maybe Jeff Kremen, one of our principal engineers, would have the answer to that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson, while he's coming down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Mason and the testifier are talking across each other. I think he's talking about hookups to individual properties that may run across a farm field, and I believe Representative Mason's talking about the main pipeline that the company owns that may be running across private transfer across private field that is actually owned by the pipeline company, not that individual owner. I think that's what the confusion is going on right here.
We'll see if the new testifier can elucidate us. Please identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Jeff Kremen, and I'm a principal engineer with the Office of Pipeline Safety. So I think I understand your question, and, you know, right now I don't believe there's any regulations that particularly cover that scenario. You know, the Public Utility Commission does routing, and they may have some provision that would require the specific utility operators to remove it. But most of our regulations are adopted from the federal regulations, and there are certain provisions of what an operator needs to do when they abandon a pipeline, but there's nothing that really requires them to continue to maintain it, except for if it's been abandoned more recently, they would still have to locate it under the Gopher State One-Call laws so that it's not inadvertently hit or misunderstood with live lines.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I believe we've exhausted that line of questioning. Thank you for coming down. I'm going to call up the legislative auditor at this point before we go any further with the department. The legislative auditor has issued a report that is directly related to the Department of Public Safety, and I welcome them here today. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Good morning, members. My name is Cecile Ferkel. I am the Deputy Legislative Auditor, responsible for the work of the Financial Audit Division. And we're here today to talk to you about a couple of recent reports that we issued in the past year or so that touched into the Department of Public Safety. Neither of these reports was a deep dive into the department or its operations, but reports where we were examining a different area and there was an aspect that involved public safety. So the first one I'd like to draw your attention to is the report titled Internal Controls Over Statewide Financial Reporting. As many of you, I'm sure, know, we do an annual audit of the state of Minnesota's financial statements. It's quite a big, involved financial report. If you're not familiar with government financial reporting, it's really full of footnotes and financial statements in many different formats. And in doing this audit, we do audit work where the primary revenues are for the state, where the primary expenditures are for the state. So we're in the big departments. And a part of that audit, there is a part of that audit where there is financial activity that we consider material to the audit. Now, when you do a financial statement audit, the audit standards require that we also provide a report in addition to the opinion that's in the financial statements related to the financial statements. The audit standards require that we also report about the internal controls that the state has put in place in order to ensure that it can prepare a good financial report. So it's an internal control report about their financial reporting process. We issue this report every year. It often has one or more findings in it. And this year it did have a finding that included public safety along with a couple of other agencies. And if it's fine with you, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have one of our audit directors, Scott Chunslin, explain that finding to you.
Absolutely. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Scott Chunslin. I'm an audit director in the Financial Audit Division of the Office of the Legislative Auditor. So referring to the report that Cecile mentioned, on page 4 of that report, in footnote 2, we explain that there's two categories of internal control deficiencies, material weaknesses and significant deficiencies. Material weaknesses are more severe and are used for deficiencies that, in our opinion, could result in material misstatements to the financial statements. Significant deficiencies are less severe and are used for deficiencies that, in our opinion, are not likely to result in material misstatements, but are still important enough for us to report. During our audit of the fiscal year 2016 CAFR, we identified one internal control deficiency that we categorized as a significant deficiency, and reported that as finding one, beginning on page 5 in our report. Now, we found that three state agencies, including the Board of Water and Soil Resources and the Departments of Corrections and Public Safety, incorrectly reported their accounts payable liabilities for fiscal year 2016, collectively overstating those payables by about $44 million. To provide a little background, the Department of Management and Budget uses the state's accounting system as the basis for preparing the state's financial statements, but the accounting system does not contain all the data necessary to accurately present those statements. One way that the department obtains additional data for financial reporting is by requesting state agencies to provide certain information. For accounts payable, the department asks state agencies to review their expenditures after the end of the fiscal year and to review their encumbrances with unspent balances as of mid-August and report back any portion that should have been reported as an accounts payable. For fiscal year 2016, an accounts payable liability should have been reported for any expenditure or unspent encumbrance after June 30th of 2016 related to goods or services received by June 30th or related to grants where grantees met all eligibility requirements for payment by June 30th. The department specifically asks agencies to review expenditures between July 1st and August 12th of $500,000 or more, and encumbrances with unspent balances of at least $500,000 as of August 12th, and report back any amount that should be reported as a payable for fiscal year 2016. The department recorded the amounts reported by the agencies as accounts payable in the draft financial statements, which totaled about $285 million. We tested a sample of the payables reported by the agencies and found errors for the three agencies cited. Expanded testing of all of the other payables reported by those three agencies uncovered more errors, totaling $44 million. Ultimately, the department corrected the errors in the draft financial statements by reducing accounts payable by that $44 million. Of that $44 million, about $13 million was from the Department of Public Safety. The department reported nearly $19 million in accounts payable related to 11 encumbrances and 3 expenditures. However, the payables reported for 4 of the encumbrances and 2 of the expenditures and for a portion of 2 other encumbrances were not actually fiscal year 2016 obligations. Our recommendation to the Department of Public Safety and to the other agencies was to improve their internal controls through additional staff training and by enhancing the supervisory review of accounts payable information to be submitted to the Department of Management and Budget.
Mr. Chair, as you can see, it's kind of deep down into the weeds of accounting and financial reporting, but that is the purpose of what this report is about. We did recommend that the Department of Management and Budget make sure that the agencies involved well understand the financial reporting and recognition requirements for the payables and that those agencies put in place controls to resolve those issues. If I can now turn to the other report.
Yes. Ms. Perkel, before you go on to that other report, let's see if we can simplify the explanation of the first one. Representative Mason has a question. Maybe that will help.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just give us some idea of what these oversights were?
Your last name again, sir?
Chumsland.
Chumsland?
Chumsland, yes.
Very good. Go ahead.
One example for public safety is there was an encumbrance of about $6.7 million related to an agreement with the Department of Transportation, and that was unspent as of August. The department reported that entire amount as a fiscal 16 liability, but when we asked them about support documentation to show that, they really didn't have any information. They basically looked like they assumed that that was all going to be 16 stuff. Once we started talking, they talked to the Department of Transportation and got some more information, and ultimately determined that $777,000 of that was a 16 obligation, the rest should have been a fiscal year 17 obligation. So they just didn't have enough information to make an accurate assessment.
Ms. Perkel.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up on that. These really are questions not about the legitimacy of the transactions, but about which fiscal year they're going to be accounted in. Do they belong in fiscal year 2016 because they meet the recognition requirements of the Governmental Accounting Standards Board for these types of expenses, or should they be recognized when the fiscal year 17 financial statements are prepared? So it's really, which fiscal year? It's a cutoff issue. It's not a questioning of the legitimacy or appropriateness of any of the payments.
Thank you. That's much clearer. Thank you for that. I don't see any other questions regarding this first report. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second report, again, is a touch into the department because of other audit work that we were doing. Again, every year we audit the state's compliance with federal grant requirements for the largest federal grant programs that the state gets. In fiscal year 16, the Department of Public Safety had one program that met that definition of a major federal program. It was the Disaster Grants Public Assistance Program, for which the department spent about $39 million in fiscal year 16. As we were doing that work, we did discover that the department had made some duplicate payments that involved both federal money and state money. There were a couple of instances of that. Those duplicate payments was totaling about $130,000. Of that, $97,000, $98,000 was federal money, and about $32,000, $33,000 was state money. So the federal government has a requirement that if we identify through our audits any inappropriate payments that exceed $10,000, we are required to report it. This report is our mechanism for that. It's in the report titled Department of Public Safety Federal Compliance Audit, and you'll see the details about it on page 5. And with that, we'd be happy to answer any other questions you may have.
Could you describe in a little more detail just what these duplicate payments are and what was the outcome?
Sure, Mr. Chair. So we tested transactions. We saw two payments to a grantee for the same dollar amount. We looked into it and found that actually they had paid the bill once and then they paid it again for the exact same cost. And then we identified that it had occurred again at a later date during the fiscal year. We do federal compliance work every year. We are back in the department right now wrapping up our work on federal grant compliance for fiscal year 16. This report actually related to fiscal year 15. We found that they have resolved this issue and resolved the duplicate payment perhaps by offsetting against future grants or by recouping the money. So we consider this issue, although we haven't officially reported it, I believe this issue is resolved.
Thank you. Representative Hausman, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The question that occurs to me is I wonder why the Buffalo Ridge Regional Rail Authority wouldn't have said you've already paid us. I mean, did that... Why would that step not have happened?
Ms. Ferkel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, certainly you would think that that would be the case. We had no indication that they were purposefully or fraudulently submitting duplicate payments. That was not part of it. When we look at internal controls within the department, we consider it a pretty weak control to expect that the recipient of the money will be your control in place. So our focus really is on the department, that they need to have processes in place to make sure that the duplicates don't occur. I don't think that we had knowledge that the grant recipient had identified it and notified the department. Perhaps they did, but our focus really was on what the department needs to do to make sure that they don't make the duplicate payments in the first place.
And then, Mr. Chair, I note on page 7 when the department responds, it says they initiated action to recover the duplicate payment, but it doesn't indicate whether that actually happened in either of those action steps.
Mr.
Chair and Representative, we have been back in the department since the time they have done the response, and we have found that the resolution has occurred.
Thank you. Any other questions for the auditors, folks, this morning? I don't see any. With that, thank you for coming in today and presenting
thank
this
you.
Information. Appreciate it. We'll get the department back up now. Ms. O'Hearn. Do you have any comments you'd like to make in relation to the auditor's report at this time? We'll see if there's any questions.
No, as to the issue that was just discussed that has been resolved, we fully cooperate with, you know, the auditors and take their recommendations seriously. With respect to the accounts payable, which was the issue of recording the transactions as occurring in fiscal year 16 when they should have been coded as happening in fiscal year 17. We have also taken their recommendation and established internal controls there as well.
Well, thank you for that, Ms. O'Hearn, and certainly the accounting for those over multiple years I could see could be a problem. But could you describe for us how you dealt with the avoiding this issue of double paying in the future? Have you put some other controls in place? What have you done?
Yes. They updated the policy with respect to really when the requirement of getting the repayment within the 30 days and requesting that, and that was not in an existing policy. So the policy has been changed on that, and I know that there has also been training. As to other controls, I cannot speak to that, and I don't have the director here from that unit. So I can provide further information. I know that the auditors have been back in there, and maybe they can answer the question better than I can at this point.
Well, thank you. Well, we trust we've been informed that the issues have been resolved, and we trust that you've taken the steps to avoid similar incidences in the future.
Yep.
I don't see any other questions regarding the auditor's report at this time. I would like at this time to, you know, I sent you a letter some time ago, and you've responded.
Yep.
with some information. Would you care to outline any of that for us today? Members, you have this in your packet. And it's quite detailed, but that's what we asked for.
Right. And so I am prepared to respond to any questions that you might have about the information. We try to respond to the questions and providing the information specifically. If there's any questions, I am prepared probably to answer them.
Yeah, could you just kind of delve into the issue of chargebacks, how they function, and what's involved with those transactions? Or do you have a phone a friend you'd like?
I am going to phone a friend here. Dan, if you could please.
Members, I realize we're kind of digging into the weeds here a bit today, but I think it's good information for all of us to understand a little better how our agencies interact. Good morning. If you could identify yourself for the record and attempt to answer my questions.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dan Boytem. I'm with the Department of Public Safety Fiscal Administrative Services Office.
So can you just describe what chargebacks are and how they function between agencies?
Various agencies provide services for departments. For instance, the buildings that public safety uses are actually owned by the Department of Administration, and our department pays Department of Administration for rent for those facilities. The administrative hearings, sometimes we get called in for a hearing. Attorney General's office, they're funded out of the general fund, and when they provide services to non-general fund activities, they build those funds. I'm just going to look over some of the main ones that were on the worksheet that was submitted to you.
Ms. O'Hearn, did you have a comment?
Well, is there a specific question that...
Well, I'm just trying to get a better understanding of the function of these chargebacks. Is there a contract established between the departments, or is it how do you budget for these things? They apparently occur year after year. Is that correct? And who adjusts the rates, for instance, that sort of thing? I'm just trying to get a little more information on how this functions.
So I will answer generally, and then Mr. Boydham will answer more specifically. Some of them are certainly established through interagency agreements and charges that you know. So, for example, for the Department of Administration, if we're paying rent, we know what that rent is, and that is something that you know what it is. We know what the legal services rates are for the Attorney General's office. We don't necessarily know how many times we're going to be sued or need to use their services, but we know what those rates are. And those rates are determined, actually in a variety of different ways, I think. But they tell us what they are, we know what they are, and do a forecast based on, our historical services with respect to that. With, I don't know, some of the other agencies. Yeah, minute services. Mr. Boydham was just directing that one of our largest areas is with minute services. We do have somebody present from minute who can maybe talk about how their rates are established, but they charge us what for their services, and that's a charge that we have to pay for our technology services.
So, and how are those rates negotiated between the departments? Is that done in advance of the work that is scheduled to be accomplished?
In all honesty, Mr. Chair, there is not a negotiated rate process, and Minute would be the one to identify how they establish their rates. We are informed what their rates are.
So what about other outside consultants? When you hire an outside consultant, and I know there's been a substantial amount of that done with the MNLARS program, are those contracted services with those outside consultants, and are they directly with the consultant, or do you work through Minute to establish those relationships?
If it is a technology service, we would work through Minute, to who would then contract. They're done through a request for proposal generally. You know, this is what we need, and that is put out. People bid on that, and that is what is established through that process. If it is a consultant of a different sort, say that Driver Vehicle Services is paying for the audit services. MNLARS, there is an auditor, and that, again, was done through an RFP contracted service, and DVS would be on the contract on that one. So there are both. With respect to MNLARS, uncontracted services, those that are technology and through Minute, and then those that are through the business through DVS.
Mm-hmm. I know we've got the Minute guy here. I thought I saw him there. Yes. Mr. Meekin, could you come forward and I realize this is kind of exploratory in nature, but, we legislators don't know everything, and we try to get educated. In the meantime, while he's coming forward, Representative Baker has a question, I believe.
And, yeah, Mr. Chair, this might tee up pretty well, too, for Minute, but also to the testifier. I see the Attorney General's office had, last couple years, a little over $500,000 each year for different reasons. I think you said sometimes you get sued, different things. Two questions I have. Can you just generally tell us what type of things do you find yourself needing the Attorney General for? If there's kind of a general theme, if you will, to some of your legal issues that you have to deal with. And again, I think what Chair Torkelson had mentioned, are those services negotiated, or is there a certain rate that you pay from the Attorney General's office that would be comparable to a private attorney that would do the same service for us as taxpayers? I'm just curious if that number has been explored. So those two questions. Thank you.
Ms. O'Hanlon.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so in the packet of information in response to the letter is a document that started with litigation, and that is a list of cases with a brief description of the type of matter that it is. So you can kind of see the breadth of... Thank you. Apparently it's the last page. See the breadth of the type of work from a car accident issue to we have a Fair Labor Standards Act case.
We don't have this? Okay.
I have it, but apparently nobody else does. But just
we
ahead.
Sent it, so there we go. I will continue. I will continue. So the accident, we had a lawsuit, 2016, defendants, or the plaintiffs in an accident involving a Minnetonka police officer and a State Patrol police officer that involved a fatal on the highways, and so that we have a civil rights lawsuit against the BCA. There's a Fair Labor Standards Act case. On occasion, there are employment law cases as well. A bulk of the legal services with the Attorney General's office are the implied consent. And there are over 200 active implied consent cases going on right now. And I don't know per, apparently it's about 200 per month. So that's a lot of implied consent cases. That's the license revocation in a DWI. And those are district court actions, and the Attorney General's office represents the state in those actions. So that is a bulk of it. I mean, there are six other lawsuits right now, so kind of balance that out. With respect to the rate, there is an established rate. My memory is not going to be able to identify what that is at the moment, but it is a lot less than what you get in the private sector. So they charge on an hourly rate for an attorney and some amount for a legal assistant and things like that. I don't want to misspeak, but it's 125 an hour, maybe 100. 100 to 125 an hour is the range of that.
Mm-hmm. But anything else on that, Representative Baker? Thank you. Well, let's switch over then a little bit to dig into Minute a little bit more. You happen to have one of the bigger numbers on the sheet, so we're happy to have you with us today. Could you just describe in a little, from your perspective, how this works with Minute itself and consultants and how those contracts are arranged and negotiated?
Sure. Mr. Chair, for the record, Paul Meekin, Chief Business Technology Officer for the Department of Public Safety. All technology contracts are, in fact, Minute contracts that then are charged back to the agency, in this case, Public Safety. We have a number of mechanisms that we use for bringing staff on. Of course, I'm only just speaking on the consulting and contracting side here. I'm not talking about state staff. There are primarily two master contracts that have been put in place with admin. One of them is called the ASAP, and that is designed as a program for bringing in staff for a year or less. So IT staff for a year or less. It's a master contract, so there are certain vendors who have applied and are on that master contract program, and then they're on that program with certain types of resources, business analysts, project managers, developers, testers, and then there is a set rate range for what that vendor can provide on that. So then when they provide a vendor, they provide a candidate, we then are able to negotiate that rate for some, but the evaluation process takes in 30% rate, or it's a value model for how we score. So we score the individual, we score 30% for the rate, and then that generally gives us the high scoring person. We will go into negotiations with that company. We do, in fact, at times ask for a rate reduction at that point. But in most cases, we let the process work it out. The 30% on the cost works it out and balances with the qualification of the individual, and we proceed with that. Those times that we do look more closely at the rate are when we look at parity across other consultants who we feel are similar on that. And so we have that ability from, say, the project, from my position, to enter into that dialogue with the vendor on that. So that was the ASAP. Our second master contract is what's called our SITE program. That program is designed for things of $2 million or less. And we do some deliverable-based work there, where we say, please come in and deliver this piece of work for us, and we price it. We also do staff augmentation that stretches beyond 12 months on that. And it's the same thing where those vendors have applied and are on the master contract, and they have an ability to have certain types of resources on there, and they have a price range, hourly price range for those types. If neither of those programs can meet our need, we do have the ability to do a full RFP, which is the full-on RFP process, no master contract. That's much more involved, takes much more time, and frankly, we only use that if ASAP or SITE can't meet our needs.
So, Mr. Meekin, it sounds, if I'm hearing you right, that some of these contracts are hourly contracts and other contracts, actually, you're contracting for a specific outcome. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and members, yeah, that's correct. On the MNLARS project, most of our work right now on the MNLARS project is priced for a what would be called a deliverable-based pricing, right? We have a very large QA contract with the vendor. That is a deliverable-based contract. A number of our other staff are based on delivery of, say, code within the deliverables that we set up on the project. We have them. We pay them for work completed on that. We do have some staff aug, which are just pay by the hour as well.
And so specifically to MNLARS, we have a number of consultant contracts, but you also have Minute employees working on the project. Can you, or don't you? Can you give me a breakdown, approximate breakdown of how much of this work is done by consultants and how much is being done by your own staff?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, we do have Minute staff working on it. I won't have the exact number for you, but a majority of our development staff, people who write the code, people who test the code, and the people who manage those people who do that, are consultants. Say more than 90% on that are consultants. The majority of the staff who set up the environments would do the operation side, right? So set up the computers, set up the network, work in the data center, all that. The majority of those people are state staff on that.
So when I was over at the department the week before last and observed a bunch of folks in there working, do these consultants come on site to do their work, or are they doing some of this work remotely?
Mr. Chair, members, the model of development that we're using puts a high emphasis on being together for closer communication. So this agile methodology that we use, we have a strong preference, almost a mandate, really. We do allow exceptions for people to work off-site from time to time, depending on the work. But for the most part, we want them co-located so that communication coordination can happen real-time.
And so let's compare what you're doing today to what happened with HP. And I realize it's ancient history and has no real, besides the things we're still using, has not a real impact on what's going on today. But what was the model when HP was on board?
Mr. Chair and members, initially the model with HP was off-site development center. They had at least two development center, different locations. One was actually in Mexico and another one was somewhere else in the U.S., down in Texas. And we were at that time following what's called the waterfall method, where we would spend a tremendous amount of time gathering up requirements, get sign off on it, and then it would get sent to the development center. They would develop the code, and then they would ship it back to us, and we would test it at that time. At the very end of our engagement with HP, we switched to an agile model with them for our new work. So the code that was near going to production, which was done on the old style, we continued down that way. And then as we look forward to the next release of MNLARS with them, we started to use this agile method with them. But there was such difficulty getting that first release in that we then proceeded to have a separation with them.
Very good. I know this really isn't part of the program today, but where are we at today? Are we still on schedule? Are we do we feel like things are coming together? Perhaps Ms. Olson would like to come up too and give us an update on just how we're doing. I realize it hasn't been too long since our last update, but this is a very important activity, and as you know, I'm very interested in what's happening over there. And if you could comment to Ms. Olson, especially in regard to how this relationship between Minute and the consultants is working for you at the department.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Dawn Olson, and I'm the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services at the Department of Public Safety. Mr. Chair and members, as far as where the project is standing today, we are still working through some of the challenges that we faced in January when we had a delay on opening up the training and getting the adoption phase rolled out. But we continue to make progress on that, and we're moving ahead diligently. We've done some reorganization on the project to put people focus solely on coming to resolution around what those issues are. And we feel very confident with the path that we're on. As far as the working relationship with Minute and the consultants and kind of the working situation we have right now, I'll speak from the heart on this. Paul and I have been on this project for a very long time. When we made the decision to let HP go in 2014, I can't say that we had a very good working relationship at that time. Sometimes when you have a third party in the mix, things can get a little awkward. It's like a three-legged stool, doesn't work quite so well, and things can get a little tense and a little bit more challenging. But when we made the decision that we were going to end this agreement, we knew that at that point we only had to go forward, and that the best way for us to do that was to build this system internally and form a partnership between public safety and Minute to move forward. And I think that made all the difference in the world with these two state agencies coming together to commit to getting this project up and running and finishing what we started has gone a long way. We are now very close-knit working state agencies. There's trust, there's respect, there's responsibility between our agencies on what we need to do because we're in this together. We don't have a third party that's coming in and kind of stirring the pot and making some, you know, less than truthful statements about the system. So I think it really helps that we're two state agencies because we care and we're committed to what we do in the state of Minnesota because we're the ones that are going to have to live with the results of this system. And that means something to the both of us as well as to the team members that are working on that. So we are very proud of the consultant process that we've had to go through. We're fortunate that we lose very few consultants. It's a fluid market. They can come and they can go as they see fit, but I think we have something special that we're offering at public safety because we lose very few consultants. We have a very very small percentage of turnover that actually happens. So you know, it's like anything. It's a work in progress, but we've been at it now for a couple of years, and I think it's working like a very well-oiled machine at this point compared to where we were 2-3 years ago when we had to turn this around and take this on.
Well, thank you, Ms. Olson. I truly appreciate your being so candid with us because this is very important work, and we really do want to have a good outcome for the state of Minnesota. There's no doubt about that, and it is challenging. There's no doubt, we're looking for better things in the future, so thank you for that. Representative Runbeck has a question.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Olson. Secondhand, but I have a question that came from a deputy registrar, and they're talking about or asking, are we still using the Windows 7 as the operating system, which may not have, you know, continued long support from Microsoft?
Mr. Meekin, maybe that's for you.
Mr. Chair, members, I don't actually know. We only use supported operating systems. I just want to be clear on that we wouldn't. Microsoft will discontinue support of operating systems. I don't know right now what the date is for Windows 7 for that, so I'll have to come back to you on that. For the 7... 10, 8. I'm going to have to come back to you on that when the support was lost for 7, if that's all right.
Follow-up, Representative Remy.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Meekum, then, if it's true that it's Windows 7, which apparently this registrar believes it is, does that... Are we on a system that is not going to be, you know, as permanent as it needs to be? as far as software for the registrars.
Mr. Meekin.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm sorry, could you repeat that last bit as far as...
I mean, is it a system that is going to be equipped and able, you know, to handle into the future for the deputy registrars and everyone using it, this system?
Mr. Meekin.
Mr. Chair, members, we absolutely look carefully at which Microsoft software is currently in support and where it's going and which software is going out of support. And so that's at the client level. You're talking Windows 7 or Win 7. At the client, you know, we, of course, have this in the servers and with the databases and with all the other software that we have. But this is a big deal. We spend a lot of time making sure that we have the correct support for that.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And Mr. Meekin, along those lines, so I think what President Brombeck is trying to be assured of is that the system is robust and sustainable in spite of potential changes in support and operating systems. And you're confident that you're addressing that?
Mr. Chair, yes, I am.
Thank you. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've had a chance recently, too, to stop over a minute, and with a new select committee on innovation and kind of a technology-driven kind of a customer service desire the speaker has here to put a group together to kind of talk about these kind of ideas, and looking forward to working further with Minute. I love the enthusiasm that we saw the other day, and I know and I appreciated hearing from you, Ms. Olson, about you feel the relationship with Minute is very solid. I'm looking forward to working with that. I like to see the tones that you guys are carrying right now. But you eloquently stated, Ms. Olson, that there's still some issues you're working through, and you said it, you're making progress. I'm just trying to find out, is it a coding issue? Is it not enough help to get the job done? Is it a clear path? Are there still some ideals from people that are trying to still bump heads a little bit? I'm not trying to get you. I just want to know what is sort of causing those nicely worded problems you're having. That's kind of getting us to that point. I'm just curious to know what is that. I'm a business guy, so I want to dive a little bit deeper if I could, and then I'll move on. Thank you,
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, you know, it's kind of a typical work environment. You know, coming from a business community where you bring in individuals that have had different experiences, different software development experiences, they bring that to the equation. And so there's always a discussion, are there better ways that we could do this? Are there more efficient ways that we could do this? And you add new people to the team. You know, we're starting to ramp up the driver services side. We bring in people that have had no exposure to how this process works. So we've got new business people coming in. They're not familiar with how this process rolls. When I say we're a well-oiled team, the motor vehicle side of the project is very well-oiled. They've worked together. They understand the nuances. They're working through things. And they've just formed a good, solid working relationship. You start immersing new people in there that haven't had that same experience. They may feel a little lost, a little intimidated, not so sure what their role is. So it's kind of a constant refresh. It's assurances. You know, we're asking people to take on roles that they've never had before, especially from the business, and that is you need to make decisions about how this is going to look in the future, and we'll support you, but, you know, you have to make these decisions timely, and you have to keep moving, and we're on a pretty regimented pace here. And so it's just reassuring some people that it's okay. We've got confidence in you. You can move forward. It's giving people those opportunities, which is wonderful for the business to be able to draw from the staff that have that knowledge and know what they want in a system. They've gone through the aches and pains, but sometimes it can be a little intimidating to put them in that environment and say, okay, you're here because you have ideas and suggestions. Now let's put them into practice. You know, it's a day-to-day discussion, but my statement was really more from where we were in 2014. It was a very difficult time for all of us on the project, losing the vendor, our working relationship being strained after, you know, a period of time, and then figuring out how are we going to put those things aside and put together a product that will move forward. I feel very confident that the leadership of that team really set the course for that. So others could say, okay, that's something in the past. We're going to let that go. and we're going to strive to move ahead. And it just set the course for getting us to this point now. And I think from what Paul and I have experienced on this project, we have something that we can replicate to other state agencies on how you can approach this and be successful and get the job done. But everybody's got to put their egos aside and come to the table and say, what is it we're going to do and how are we going to get this done? And so the challenge is, like I said, it's just day-to-day stuff, the nuances of a typical kind of new team, introducing new people, having different ideas. But we have a lot of communication. There's a lot of communication and planning that goes into this project. So those ideas and suggestions can come forward, can be talked through, and resolved at that juncture.
A follow-up person.
And thank you, Ms. Olson. I appreciate that tone. I know how it works to bring people together as new people are coming and going. And I'm sure your team knows the legislature is getting impatient, and we need some results. And I think your model that you want to deliver to other agencies is going to be a lot more embraced when the project is done. And we have something to really show them. So I encourage you to keep pushing. Leadership is tough. It's not fun to be at the top, and it's lonely there. But I wish you all the very best, and I hope we have a product we can all be proud of very soon. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Olson, I couldn't help but smile internally when you were describing the three-legged stool, because that's what we deal with here at the legislature with the governor and the Senate every day.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I appreciate your feedback. And I appreciate your support. You know, it's hard to emulate support and talk in a setting like this about the good things that we have accomplished, but I am incredibly proud of the project that we've put together and the work that the people have done. Paul and I can come here and discuss the challenges and maybe some of the frustrations with this committee and other committees like that. But our team is very much committed to standing this up. They understand. They know. They are absolutely working at top level to make sure we deliver that. And we are very proud of what we're seeing. I feel very confident that you're going to be just as pleased with what you see and that we can share this with other agencies as a model, not only for the state of Minnesota, but for other states in the country. Because other states are dealing with this same situation, they need to replace their mainframe systems, especially on the motor vehicle and driver's license portion. And states are, you know, struggling because of the complexity and the nature of a project this size. So we feel that we can also bring this to other states that are having similar issues.
Ms. Olson, just one final thing I would like you to address, and that is in regard to the Real ID. Mm-hmm. Potential of that becoming part of the need here in Minnesota. Have you been in contact with other states that have been issuing real IDs or with the federal government in relation to what you might need to do to get your system up and running in a timely fashion?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, yes, I have, especially as the conversation has been going around since the beginning of this session. Most recently, I've been talking to the Department of Homeland Security, the ones that would review our application when we submit that forward. All indications are that the next step for Minnesota is to pass the law. That is what they're waiting to see from us. And I think once this legislature makes their determination on what that will be, we'll be in much better shape to move forward.
So they told you if we pass the law, if they're going to extend the deadline, or?
Mr. Chair, that is what they said that they're looking for the extension, is a law that is passed by this legislature and signed into law by the governor.
That's promising. Thank you. I think at this point I'd like to bring Ms. O'Hearn back up. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Nelson, I missed you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I had goes back to Mr. Meekum when he was talking about coding and writing code. And going back to the issue with HP, who owns that code? I mean, with HP, do we just throw everything they did away and start from scratch, or are we using some of that? And do we own that code, or are we going to have to be paying license fees into the future to HP for what the work that they did?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Meekum.
Yeah, member. State owns that code. We, in the initial contract, we made sure that the state had full rights to the code. We have released one of that code in production, which we are currently using for permits and identity access management on that. And they gave us, they, in addition, they gave us all of their the code assets when they departed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. I think we've covered that thoroughly. Ms. O'Hearn, this may be something you need to dig into offline, but one of the things I'm very interested in is trying to determine if there's any way that we can use more of our trunk highway fund for building roads and less of it for other purposes. As I look through the information you've presented to us, we're spending a lot of trunk highway fund money in DPS operating your systems and paying employees. Do you think there's any opportunities there for us to, you know, refocus on building roads?
The Department of Public Safety certainly is a recipient of trunk highway funds. The department has provided information both in response to your request, Mr. Chair, as well as in the report that was issued in January of 2016 identifying exactly where trunk highway funds go. The department works very hard to ensure that those divisions and those employees who work or that are funded using trunk highway funds are that their work is related to activities of the trunk highway and transportation issues. So it I think as you dig into those and we certainly can have a conversation offline or more in depth about specific questions with respect to how that money is being used, but the department does work to ensure that monies are in fact used for the appropriate person. If I could use an example that I just learned about from Colonel Langer as an example, when they purchase ammunition for the troopers, road troopers, that is provided, and they use trunk highway funds for that. When they purchase ammunition for troopers that are assigned to the Capitol complex, they do not use trunk highway funds for that ammunition. So even that level of detail of splitting out, is it an activity that is directly related to the highways or an activity that is not related to the highways, to ensure to the best that we can that is that the trunk highway funds are being used for trunk highway purposes.
Thank you. Representative Rumbek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. O'Hearn, looking at this detail of the different departments and their expenditures, when you see this statewide indirect costs, and many of the departments have such a cost, and what would the what's an example of what that might be?
So,
Ms. O'Hearn.
I am trying to identify, sorry, which?
Well, account number 42010. For admin, for driver and vehicle.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get the, excuse me. Is it the act?
From the memo.
From right, is it the actual expenditures?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Miss me. Miss O'Hearn.
Yeah, I'm trying to, so the and this separates out, I'm sorry, could you repeat your question?
By department, it shows up in most departments as having expenditures, hundreds of thousands of dollars, it looks like, statewide indirect costs, grand total. Or are these, I mean, I guess maybe help me understand what I'm looking at then. So, fiscal year 16, driver and vehicle services had $521,000 in statewide indirect costs.
Admin had $355,000 in statewide indirect costs.
I'm sorry, I'm trying to make sure that I have the right
and
thing that I'm... Dan, do you...
We're all shuffling paper here, Matt. Yep. We're trying to figure
okay.
out
right. the first I don't even that. See a... I don't have a page number, so I can't help you beyond that. But
this report?
Right. It would be in the kind of the fine print, about six pages in. DPS transportation actual expenditures.
Okay. And repeat your question, please.
Okay, so you see an item, a line item, okay, statewide indirect costs, and it shows up in most departments, and it's several hundred thousand dollars in most departments. There's one department that has zero, but...
Mm-hmm. And we're trying to get a description of...
I'd just like to know what that
what
might
are
be.
Statewide indirect costs? Yes, is the question. And if you don't have the answer right now, we can always get it later.
Mr. Chair, Dan Poitem from Public Safety Fiscal Administrative Services. I'll try to answer the question on indirect costs the best I can. Agencies, non-general fund agencies, get billed for general fund activities that are provided for all the agencies. MMB, Minnesota Management Budget, is a general fund activity. They have an accounting system called SWIFT that they provide for all the funds. We have other agencies like the legislative auditor, but agencies get billed for general fund activities that are provided for non-general fund activities. That it is an indirect cost plan that Minnesota Management and Budget prepares, that they identify how much all the various costs for the accounting system and other things that they have. That I don't have that particular worksheet in front of me, but there are like about 20 different items that they bill agencies on an annual basis for. And so when you look at driver license vehicle services, which is funded out of the special revenue fund, and that $521,000 that you're talking about, that is for services that are provided by MMB and all the other
That's helpful, sir. I appreciate that.
And I could provide you what their indirect cost billing looks like if need be. It is something that is a regular bill.
Sure, if you can put something together that would help us be educated, and that'd be great. Okay, at this time, I would like to explore the issue of the request from the department for a new helicopter, and I don't know who wants to address that. I would guess someone in a uniform, maybe. But and not just the need, but also the justification for using trunk highway funds for the major portion of that potential purchase. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Matt Langer. I serve as the Chief of the State Patrol.
Thank you. So we have a request from the department for this purchase of a new helicopter. Can you describe the need? And then also, I don't know who would describe how we are asking for the funding.
Mr. Chair, I'll do my best. I don't have the sheet in front of me. I apologize. I didn't know we were going over initiatives today, but I know the ask well, and I know the need well. The State Patrol has three helicopters. We've had three for many, many years. The newest of those three helicopters is a 2005 Bell 407. It's a little bit complicated if you're not into aviation or helicopters, but the Bell 407 that is 11 years old was purchased with federal grant money at the time, and that is fully mission capable. That can do everything that we need it to do. It can do life safety missions. pulling people out of places where they can't get out on the ground if they're injured or if they're lost. It can do wildlife firefighting with a bucket. It can do all of the long line rescue. It can do all of the infrared tracking, both for people that are avoiding law enforcement and people that are lost. It can do everything. The other two helicopters are aged. One is currently not airworthy because it experienced an emergency landing last year. At this point today, the FAA and the NTSB have yet to come up with a cause for that emergency landing, which is troubling, but they've ruled out the major components and, to my knowledge, have ruled out any error on behalf of the pilot. So as we stand today, we have two helicopters that are airworthy. The third one that is airworthy is the oldest in the fleet. It's approaching 10,000 hours of time in the air. Its life is done for all practical purposes, and it cannot do the mission safety, the life safety mission work that I explained with the 407. It cannot do the lifting. It cannot do the long line rescue of hunters or injured people, and it cannot do the wildlife firefighting with the bucket. It can do some overhead surveillance, but it doesn't have all of the capabilities of the 407. So it doesn't help us much toward the life safety issues that we can do it with our fleet. The helicopter that is not airworthy right now could do those full life safety missions. So as it stands right now, we have one helicopter that can provide all of the services across the entire state of Minnesota that we get called upon to provide. And if I assume members are sort of aware of those life safety missions, I can give some examples if that's helpful. But with one helicopter that provides all that service, there's a pretty significant amount of downtime, both from maintenance and repair. So one helicopter, we plan for that helicopter to be down, meaning out of service, for 6 to 8 weeks per year, which leaves us with a pretty significant gap where we would not be able to provide service if called upon to respond. So the ask that's in the governor's budget is for a new 407 helicopter, and as part of that ask, we would downsize our fleet to two, and that would make us more efficient. It would also help us with pilot training, because we would only train our pilots on one airframe instead of training pilots across two different airframes with the Long Rangers that we currently have and the 407.
Very good. Thank you for that. And then as far as how we are proposing to fund this purchase, I don't know if you're the one to address that or someone else.
I can, Mr. Chair and members. So just like the Deputy Commissioner explained how we split ammunition purchases between the General Fund and Trunk Highway, we fully realize and are completely transparent that not every hour that the helicopter is flying is directly related to Trunk Highway purpose. So the exercise that we used this year was similar to what we did last year working with MMB when they requested it, to split out based on the data by percent the time that particular helicopter would be projected to be used for Trunk Highway specific purpose or general fund specific purpose. Example being, and we do get these calls, if we get a call of a local or county agency that has an injured party in the Boundary Waters with a hip fracture, they can't get that person out without terrible delay or further injury to that person, they would call us, we would respond. That would be an example of a general fund-related purpose. If tonight a local agency or the state patrol is pursuing a stolen vehicle and our desire is to get the helicopter up as fast as we can to safely mitigate that pursuit and bring it to the safest closure possible, that would be a Trunk Highway purpose that we would put under that Trunk Highway percentage. So based on previous data, we tried to do our best to segregate general fund and Trunk Highway dollars for this ask.
And are you aware of other airplane purchases that have been done in a similar fashion? I'm especially focused on the Trunk Highway Fund.
Mr. Chair, members, last year we had a $975,000 legislative request that we were successful in getting, and that was for a fixed-wing aircraft. And we did the exact same thing where we split the percentage for that fixed wing between Trunk Highway and general funds, and actually received two appropriations to make up the $975,000.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And we ever used bonding money for a purchase like this in your experience?
Mr. Chair, members, no, we have not to my knowledge.
Okay. Very good. I think I don't see any other questions from members this morning. We're going to end a little early. I don't think anyone will read.
What's that?
So I'm going to adjourn this meeting. Thank you very much.